Tactical Breakdown Podcast, episode 25, part 2. This is the continuation from episode 25 of our instructor's roundtable on use of force and defensive tactics. Let's jump back into it.
Welcome to the Tactical Breakdown, a podcast for law enforcement, military, and emergency response professionals.
Stand by.
Where we help you bridge the gap and talk training, tactics, and leadership with the best subject matter experts in the world. Here is your host, Adam Kanakin.
Welcome back. This is part two of our three-part episode pulled from our instructor's roundtable on use of force and defensive tactics. If you are jumping right into this second part episode, I would recommend you go back and check out part one. It'll give you some context as to the conversation, but it's all good nonetheless. Thank you for being here. Again, a huge thank you to our sponsor for this episode, Blauer Tactical Systems. Make sure to check them out at blauerspear.com and use the code TACTICAL if you're looking at purchasing any courses on there. They're going to help you out. So let's get back to the table with our instructors on use of force and defensive tactics. Here we go. One thing I cycled back, my head finally caught up with everything else you guys are talking about. When we talk about additional training, because I was brought up earlier and what we can do for additional training, what systems are acceptable and or unacceptable as far as an agency perspective? Because that's a big thing, right? I mean, Tony, the spear system's a little bit different. I mean, like I said at the beginning of the show, I don't think there's an agency that out there that doesn't implement that in some way, shape, or form. But like you always say, it's kind of that. I can't remember who did the video for you, or part of the interview, but essentially it's the 3 seconds before the fight, right?
That was something that Bob Willis said in, holy shit, it was like 1993 or 95.
Right.
Way back. Well, it was just, you know, my whole thing is like, you know, in that line, it's one of our slides in our presentation, like, you know, control tactics don't work in out of control scenarios. And I'm talking specifically about the tactics. You've got to weather the ambush. And when you look at violence inside the reactionary gap, you look at cops getting sucker punched, having their guns taken, getting knocked to the ground. And I study thousands and thousands of these. In fact, John would remember this from back in Fletsy. That's where I first met him years ago in the 90s. But I created it was a funny name. It was called How to Watch a Dashboard Video. And it was these 8 stages of reverse engineering to study, you know, this dashboard video, because I was like looking at the way people were training, and it was, okay, how do you get out of a headlock? How do you stop gun grab? What do you do when the guy punches you? And I'm going, well, wait a minute. There's a whole bunch of telegraphic micro movements before that, but if you start everything from the headlock, from the rear strangle, from the tackle, from the gun grab, years before I came up with it, you know, before the 10,000 hours things became famous, and I was able to say you're always doing that one rep of allowing the attack to happen. And so the notion here really is how can we, you know, we talk about getting to the left of the ambush, left of bang, right? So, but everyone practices, and I say everyone just to be generalize and be provocative, because I want people to really get safer and think about this. If you say head on a swivel, welcome back. if you say head on a swivel, left of ambush, and then all your training is to the right of the ambush, meaning, hey guys, if you see him target glance your gun, do this, do that. Okay, guys, let's get on our scenario gloves. Okay, partner, stand in ready stance. Okay, grab the gun and go. Like, you're jumping dissonance. You're jumping the emotional, psychological pre-contact cues. You're, and this is really where the interleaving, the understanding of a three-dimensional interleaving can come into play, where I'm teaching, instead of, I used to make a joke, when people would ask me if I did weapon retention, I would say, you don't have a holster? And they go, yeah, we do. I go, well, weapon retention is your holster. And they go, huh? I go, weapon protection is your skill set, your mindset. Weapon retention is your holster. You don't want a retention drill. If a bad guy's grabbing your gun, you need to be fighting. And it just changed the emotional content of that scenario. And they were built slowly. And I love something that that Chris said earlier about the high fidelity scenario. And I loved, you know, the reframe that you don't need to scare the shit out of people and have their heart rate at 188 beats a minute. You can intelligently stress inoculate, and you just got to know what you're doing. So it was actually a weapon protection course that Bob saw me teach, and he came up to me after and he said, you teach the 3 seconds before the fight that the rest of us teach. And it was a huge compliment, but that's been my niche, is that if you don't weather that ambush, and we have an expression here, and I'm glad we could swear on the show, and it goes like this. It says, if you're scared shitless, unconscious, or dead, you're not getting to your next move. Scared shitless, unconscious, or dead, you're not getting to your next move. You got to weather the ambush. All fights are dangerous, but the most dangerous fight is the ambush, because neurologically, it hijacks executive function. That's why, you know, every time you see a cop get dragged by a car, someone goes, why are they grabbing the car? They're not grabbing the car. That's the cross-extensive reflex locking on. If I'm on a door frame, you know, using that as a leverage to post it under the car, and they slam the car and drive, and I micro-flinch, I'm locked onto the car. Nobody thinks they can stop a car, but it's simple physiology, not understanding. That's why they teach, like, an electrical school, if you're going to check if a wire has any current on it, they always tell you to use the back of your hand, right? So if this happens, that's not where they find you fried, right? So this cross-extensor reflex, that's everything that was like, so the little spear system became like, it's like your body's biological airbag. And if you learn how to weaponize it so that you micro-flinch, you pop out, it's like an airbag deploying between you and the threat. So, It's all based on physiology and neuroscience, and it seamlessly integrates whether you're doing Gracie grapple, Krav Maga, control force, PPCT, like any, whatever your system is. I don't talk about the complex motor skills. No, that's like arguing like what's better, like a SIG or a Glock. Like if you're scared shitless, unconscious, or dead, it doesn't matter that you had a gun that you couldn't get to.
Yeah, it's really, that's what I was, the point I was getting, you made it perfectly, is that agencies have fully implemented what you guys teach and what you've come up with, because it isn't that, it doesn't fall into that use of force category, essentially, right? I mean, it's that reaction. It's that officer's instinctual reaction to danger and getting them through that initial first few seconds. Now, when we take about taking that and transitioning into something different is where I think we start to find a lot of issues. You know, when we talk about officers taking training on their own time, Chris and John and Scott would have a better idea of this than I would, but we've seen it where officers have taken like a Krav training course and implemented that on the street. And now they're doing an investigation and use of force. And they say, well, where did you learn that technique? Well, I learned it in my dojo or my school. And they said, well, that's not approved. Now there's an issue. So has that hasn't happened? Can you guys?
No, people will say that. Yeah. But it doesn't hold any weight. Bottom line is, at least, again, here in the United States, and I know Canada is just a hair different, but basically we have the same rules and laws on objective reasonableness. The truth of the matter is, the whether I learned it from outside source, inside source, when it comes to the actual determination of whether it's actually an excessive use of force, the question is, was it reasonable? Could a reasonably well-trained, similarly situated officer have done the same thing under similar circumstances? That's what the standard is. So the question isn't, I'm not suggesting that we don't qualify with firearms. But the truth of it does not really go to the point of whether the force was reasonable. Was deadly force reasonable? That's the question. The example I've always used is, if you're in a knockdown drag out fight and you're trying to keep your weapon in, and you're fighting over him. And as I love the term that Tony, you're trying to protect your, what, you're fighting. And if there's a brick nearby, a chunk of concrete or something like that. Guess what? If you use that and you strike somebody in the head, that's deadly force. Now, nobody's going to come back later and say, you know, hey, we'd like to see the training records on your, you know, brick use training class. It's just not going to happen. So people, there's a kind of a misnomer out there about that. What the court's really looking at that moment, they want to know, again, the prevailing case law in the United States on that is Scott v. Harris, where that comes into a case of, you know, running somebody off the road into an embankment. Supreme Court said clearly that it was a use of deadly force. The only question they wanted to go back is based on the totality of circumstances, was that reasonable at the time? And in that particular case, the court found it was reasonable. So I've always, I think this is more on the officer themselves to do your homework. My friend Kevin Davis out of Akron, great use of force mind, has great use of force investigation book. And I've heard Kevin say, you know, a billion times, vet your instructors, vet your training companies. There's some people out there doing a great job, and there are people just doing crap training, trying to make a buck. That's not evidence-based, science-based. So that's on the officer to make sure they're really vetting people properly. But again, it doesn't matter that you learned something in the dojo. The question is, was it reasonable at the moment force was used? So that's maybe a myth that if you were, sorry, that's where I left off was the myth stuff, I think. So.
No, that's perfect. Yeah, no, sorry, I should have prefaced it. That was, so a question that had come in was when, because they've been told from other instructors that if I come into a course and the instructor says, you can't take this because we don't teach it. Because their agency says, well, it's not taught, we don't teach it, so we don't approve it, therefore you can't use it.
Yeah,
that's kind of where that question had come from. I may have phrased it incorrectly.
So again, at least here in the United States, and again, there's a difference between policy and law, right? Some people think that if you violate a policy, then you've also by proxy violated the law. So the example I use on that is, let's say we have an agency policy that says you have to wear a pink cowboy hat while you're out on patrol. Just a ridiculous policy. Well, guess what? If you want to work for that agency, that's the requirement. You got to wear a pink cowboy hat on patrol. Now, I go out tonight. I get myself involved in a deadly force encounter, for example. I use deadly force and, you know, the smoke is clear and we come back and realize that my, you know, my force was good. It goes to court. The judge could care less whether I have my pink cowboy hat on. It's completely irrelevant to the determination of reasonableness. Now, my agency could fire me for it. Okay, that's possible. But when you're talking about determining the reasonableness of a use of force incident, it literally is the severity of the crime or the you know totality of circumstances from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene at the moment force was used. That is a standard that all courts in the United States are required to follow.
And Adam, I just want to support what you're saying, though. I think where that myth comes from is not that the courts have ruled that you can't use X, Y, and Z training or anything like that. It's individual agencies, yep, right, expressing some kind of hesitancy, fear. So the example would be like, you know, a young officer wants to put in for a, you know, underwater knife fighting, you know, class or something like that. Agency doesn't see it as being relevant to the job function, so they deny it. Maybe that perpetuates the myth. But there's one other factor that agencies do concern themselves with. And I know one of the questions that was submitted before the talk was something about, gee, why doesn't my agency, you know, approve me to go to this training class and that kind of stuff. Something agencies concern themselves with is the legal doctrine of negligent training. And they don't always understand maybe how it works, or they're worried about, okay, if we send the officer, meaning pay for the officer or send them on duty and they receive some sort of training, has the agency tacitly approved that training, even though they're not real sure, you know, what the outline is, they have no way of knowing what the instructor is going to say, is now this on-duty employee going to come back and use something and could rightfully so later go, wait a minute, this is how I was trained. You know, I went to the you know, brick fighting school or whatever was mentioned, and I use it all the time. You know, I'm hitting people with bricks left and right. You sent me. It's not my fault. I thought this was official training from my department. So there's other little subtle nuances there, but it's not the courts are going to say, where'd you get that training from kind of thing.
That's a good point. And I've heard a lot of guys over the years go, you know, is this post approved, state approved, T-close approved? It's not. And I would always explain politely, like your policy or your state says this is the minimum amount of skills that you need to be exposed at and proficient in. They don't say you can't get better, which goes back to what you said early on, and Scott, like, you know, you need to be doing more. And I wrote an article for Caliber Press a couple of years ago about this, saying like, you need to be showing up to work as if this is the NFL. But it's 24/7, 365 days. You got to show up in shape. You got to stay in shape, and you don't know when someone's going to hit you illegally. And you don't always know who has the ball or where the ball is, but you know, pick your sport, whatever you like, but you got to be in shape and you got to do it on your own. And then there'll be team practices. But if you want to be, rest in peace, Kobe Bryant, but you want to be the guy who is training at 4 a.m. because you want to be the best. And, you know, anyone in law enforcement who doesn't think that the job is dangerous, I mean, it blows my mind when I see officers who don't take their training seriously and aren't in the best shape that they can be, or at all complacent about it. But that's all.
Chris, any points from a Canadian Commonwealth perspective there, or kind of the same idea as it is in the U.S.?
So I have not encountered a single criminal case where an officer has been convicted because they used a technique that was not provided by specifically by their police department. So the question will always come down to is, based upon the officer's perception at the time the officer decided to use force, was force necessary? In other words, was it required at the time? And was the force the officer used, was it acceptable? In other words, within the realm of reasonableness, was it proportionate to the harm that the officer was facing? And not the question isn't, where was that provided to the officer in training? I'll give you an example of that. We had an officer come into the academy from the UK. The officer had been a professional rugby player and a phenomenal officer in training. But shortly after the officer graduated the academy, got in a physical fight where an individual attacked him, and the officer used a headbutt on the individual. And so the executive's asking me, they're all up in arms going, but we don't teach headbutts. I'm going, it doesn't matter. That's not the question. Is what was the harm the officer faced? What was an appropriate response that was proportionate to the harm in order to control that level of violence? And, you know, if you could have punched the individual in the head, and we teach punches or elbow strikes or whatever, then a headbutt's within the range of proportionality. So it's the same here. And it's not only training, it's officers bring all kinds of skills and backgrounds from their entire life that may not be formal combative training, but high level athletics, different types of skills from that level that the brain under rapidly unfolding. And Tony mentioned that, that short stimulus response, recognition, prime decision-making. Look, the decision isn't, oh, I'm going to access something I used in my training. It's where's the threat? And then there's a stimulus and a response. And whatever is the most heavily programmed, myelinated motor response in the officer's brain for that context is what's going to come out. So was it proportionate? Was it required? Those are the questions.
Great.
We're starting to get into a lot of the smaller, the micro stuff now. Different techniques have been brought up and things like that. So that was one of the things that we were going to talk about was techniques, training, different systems, things like that are acceptable, aren't acceptable, maybe things that we're moving into or moving away from. We could start with talking about techniques that shouldn't be used anymore or should be being brought in, or we could talk about training systems. Does anybody have a preference?
Well, listen, let me start with something that doesn't work. And that sounds fun.
Should we all get comfortable? Or?
Get comfortable. It's going to take a long – no. You know, in law enforcement police training, 17-step baton, you know, routines, this, okay, to the front and then to the back and then the side and then all this stuff and trying to memorize that. What else doesn't work in the long term? Training in something, anything, once a year, twice a year, that's probably not going to work. What else doesn't work? 15-step handcuffing techniques for people that don't want to get handcuffed. What else doesn't work? Fighting. We used to call it the red man in the academy. Now it's called, I think, sustained resistance fighting. It's a guy dressed up in pads, and they hand you a limp like a baton, and then this monster comes after you. Yeah. And I'll never forget, like a really smart officer I used to work with said, you know, if this ever happens to me on the street and this monster who I cannot hurt is coming after me, you know what a move I'm going to use? And I was like, oh, I'm all ears, because this guy was kind of a proficient fighter. He goes, I'm going to run as fast as I freaking can away from that guy because he's trying to kill me. And I was like, that's interesting. He goes, furthermore, if somebody starts shooting at me and they got the drop on me at a car stop, as opposed to trying to draw, acquire the target and back up and move my feet really quick backwards and go back to the car like we're trained in, he's like, I'm going to create an angle between this guy and run as fast as I can the other direction. And I went, that's not how we're trained. You know, and wait, I thought cops, we can't, little things like that, like realistic types of things. If someone's trying to kill you, get away from them, you know, defend yourself. And if you think, you know, I'm going to memorize this very complicated technique and I'm sort of practice it once a year when it's time for defensive tactics refresher training, and somehow, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to remember that and I'm going to use that in a real live fight with a determined aggressor, not my fellow officer who's dressed up in pads or has gloves on or is going, hey guys, 25% speed on this one. I mean, a real fight. Yeah. I think we're kidding ourselves. Yeah.
So I'll just add on to what Scott's saying. There's some things, for example, handcuffing, right? Everybody, there's 1,000 different techniques. And like Scott said, I remember us going through some training. It was like an 8 or 9 step thumb lock, twist, whatever. So I've always thought, listen, there's, you know, a couple different ways of handcuffing. To me, the most important thing, and Scott, you alluded to this earlier, the most important thing about handcuffing is get them on quickly. So instead of requiring somebody, well, you have to do a speed cuffing technique. That's just what we teach. Or you have to do non-weapon hand. At the end of the day, the priority in handcuffing is getting them on quickly. So I'm going to show you 3 or 4, and then we're going to practice. And guess what? We'll figure out which one works the best for you as an individual, and that's the one we're going to spend time on, let you use it in scenario-based training and things like that. Got Chris Serino out of Ohio. Great. A lot of people know Chris, and he's doing some fantastic work. And a lot of you might know him from Top Shot. But Chris told me this. He said, I said, what are your thoughts on isosceles versus Weaver versus modified? That's stupid conversation. To me, I say it's a stupid conversation because it's whatever works for you. Meaning, listen, if I have a new officer on the range and let's say they're shooting isosceles, and it's not working for them, but they modify and they do a modified Weaver, okay, and they're hitting the target, they're performing well, then I'm probably going to let them perform the way that they're naturally inclined to perform well. Now, again, I know the arguments for having, isosceles and squared up body armor and things like that, but let's find out what their natural position is and see if we can't hone that a little bit. I use the example, Craig Biggio, Major League Baseball player, had one of the most goofed up stances you've ever seen in the history of the game. Well, you would never teach somebody to do that way. You just wouldn't teach it. But at the end of the day, it worked for him. He was very successful doing it. Why would we want to go in and try to modify and change that unless it's unsafe? So listen, I don't care if you teach speed cuffing, weapon hand, non-weapon. I really don't care at all. What's the fastest way for you to get cuffs on for you individually? And I think that's instructor driven, right? We just do it the way we learned it, or our agency tells us we have to. I think instructors, we got to be a little bit more open to, hey, what comes naturally to them? Because everybody on the panel tonight knows that that's probably what they're already primed and leaning towards doing in a System 1 response anyways.
Yeah, and I think along with that, John, part of the problem from an instructor perspective is instructors who focus on technique rather than outcome. And Tony's already mentioned that. Yep. And you can look at, take a takedown, for example, a simple balance displacement takedown, whether that's head off shoulders, shoulders off the hips, an armbar takedown, whatever. But if, as we're teaching that technique, if we're not drilling the philosophy and the principle and the goal into the student's mind of where the subject is now, where you want them to be, and the principles of how to disrupt balance, you know, we really should spend a lot less time being so focused on technique and getting officers to think about that, because we're actually setting them up for performance issues, performance errors, by having them focus on technique rather than goal and outcome.
Totally agree.
Right. The kids at the academy shouldn't be hyper concerned about failing out of the academy because they missed, you know, step 7 of 17 about handcuffing. You know, like Chris said, it should be like, were the cuffs, you know, put on, like John said, was it put on in a safe way? And there's a variety of ways that can happen. And then are they able to do it in the context of what they're really going to face in the field?
Right.
And any instructor who's teaching some complicated technique, I mean, maybe there's a rationale for learning those things. But the question that would occur to me is, has this been tested? You know, tested in a fight, not tested by other DT instructors. Is this the flavor of the week? Did you go to a class and learn some new technique and now you're going to go train other cops it because it's kind of neat? Or is it because it's super effective, right? And in fights, it's fast, it's messy, it's hard to get people, you know, handcuffed. It's hard to get people under control. You do need things that are kind of easy to remember, because let's not forget, defensive tactics is one of about a million things that we're asking young men and women who are police officers to be good at, right? Yeah. Now they're going to be human trafficking experts, they're terrorism experts, they shoot a variety of weapon systems, they got to be good at de-escalation, community policing, social media. Now we're going to take pictures, you know, pose for the camera. There's a gazillion things that cops have to be able to do at a moment's notice now. And so naturally, as instructors, I think, you know, we want to make things that are simple. Here's an acronym you can remember, or here's a simple concept you can use, and it'll be successful most of the time. You know, there's time to learn exotic techniques and time to specialize and time to learn, you know, the more sophisticated things. But, you know, your average patrol officer needs sort of a five, you know, techniques are going to work a lot. He reverts to them in fear upon sudden attack, sudden surprise, surprise ambush. It's going to work. It's going to function. That's why I like, you know, the guys in the panel, they're talking about things that are real, realistic based stuff.
Yeah. And along with what you said there, Scott, I appreciate that comment, is recognizing, and I don't know what your guys' perspective are as instructors, you know, abundance of experience this, but what I've seen is, you know, we've got X amount of time to train police officers, and we spend far too much time doing technique based, skill based performance, rather than let's get out of that as soon as possible and start getting into context relevant, adding resistance, adding complexity, so the officer's actually learning how to use that skill in a judgment probabilistic type of operational environment. And so who cares about technique?
Yeah, and I'm not trying to plug Tony, but I mean, from the first time I understood about the flinch response stuff, like he says, hey, you know, we're going to take something that's already naturally occurring in these environments, and then we're going to tell you how to work off of it. Right. I mean, anybody who's ever worked with Tony or has been through spear training at some point in time, their life, they know that that's where that all came from. Now you've done, obviously, Tony, a ton of different things off of that, but you know, the basic concept of flinch response that we learned 20 years ago, or 15 years ago or so, you know, I think the first time I met you with Fletzy, it was probably 2002 or 2003. So it's been a while. But you're doing exactly what everybody here is saying. Hey, take something very non-complicated. In fact, you said natural. So
yeah, it's funny. And people come to the class like, hey, did you bring your asset? And they're like, oh shit, did we forget something? I said, did you bring your physiology, biomechanics, psychology? And everyone starts to laugh. There's something that I want to add to this specific conversation, and that's, you know, we get, okay, interleaving, more realistic scenarios. Let's get out of the technique, micromanaging of ourselves or the class or the students, and have them doing, you know, scenarios where they got to make decisions, they got to communicate, and that ties into, you know, the questions that you're asking, John, and it's Socratic and all that. But what I want to point out for everyone is that self-awareness is the key. And self-awareness is that ability for us to realize, oh shit, I need to change what I'm doing right now. So I've always said that like a well-trained person knows a bunch of moves, but a really, really skilled person knows when to abort those moves. And so you could have, you know, and this I alluded to this earlier about this like theoretical egalitarian bell curve, where we teach the same skill set to the smaller female, smaller male officer, the larger, you know, to the Thor and Rambo in the academy, in service, whatever it is. And everyone learns the same moves in the department. And one of the myths were that I think it was Scott that said, you know, like when you leave your training, like really that was the minimum standard. And if you're serious, you need to keep training and you need to explore. But there's something that I always go back to when I look at something in the news and I'm going, oh shit, what was it that kept that officer in that fear loop there, where they couldn't transition mm-hmm. to another weapon system, where they couldn't either just pop away and back off and create space, or couldn't engage? You know, so, you know, we were talking about officers earlier, and there's a joke I always like to make is that some police officers think backup means move away, and like, what stops somebody from moving in to help somebody? And in all my years now, 43 years, I realize that it's our limited understanding of the neural circuitry of fear, of understanding how to use fear as a fuel, as opposed to this oppressive force that creates stagnation. And that's an interesting thing that everyone needs to be talking about or exploring in the context of scenario training, where we say, well, go pull that guy out of the car. And so Chris goes and he demos it, but you know, Chris is 225 pounds and 30 years doing it. I'm guessing how much he weighs. You know, but and he goes and he grabs the guy, and I guarantee that every small officer in the class is, if unless they're suffering from Dunning-Kruger effect, they're going, well, it's easy for him. He's big and he's an instructor, and nobody puts their hand up, because if you're a recruit, you want the check in the box. You want to graduate. Your focus is on, I just got to graduate. Yeah. So there's a whole other area I'd love you guys to you know, think about, and everyone listening, this is like, how do we teach people more about managing fear and being able to articulate that? Because at the end of the day, you know, getting your gun out of your holster or palm striking somebody or taking cover or calling 911, whatever it is, calling for backup, that's got to go through the fear loop in that decision-making loop. I remember we're teaching emergency services fire department all about the psychology of fear and stuff like this. And the captain comes to me after and he says, you know, one of my guys, you made me think of a story where one of my guys calls and he's on the radio going, okay, what, the house is on fire, and he's screaming. And when he finally got it under control, he goes up to me and says, hey, we couldn't understand you. Like, was this your house? He goes, no. Was your family in there? No. He goes, then you don't need to scream like that. It wasn't your house. Like, but it was like, he, you know, he was new to it, and he just couldn't get, you know, he couldn't get it together. So like, this is an area that I'm insanely passionate about, because I really believe if I had a choice between just teaching somebody how to recognize fear and manage it, or teach them all the skills of, like, all four of us have, like, what are our three favorite moves? That person could still freeze with all the, like, the, I call it the Frankenstein model, where we're taking the best of all these martial art combative systems. At the end of the day, if a stimulus gets introduced too quickly, that executive function gets hijacked. What are we doing right there? So everything everyone's saying is so valid, but I really want to pound that home for everybody, is, you know, got to, and the way you learn more about yourself and managing fear is what Chris has been talking about and what John was talking about. I mean, everyone is, but Chris and John in particular is intelligent scenarios.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You guys bring up a lot of points, and it kind of draws me back to one of the other things that one of the points that somebody had asked questions about, which was lowest common denominator training and going back to the training methodologies for instructors and bringing instructors in. You know, when you talk about scenarios or developing scenario-based training models or reality-based training models, there's definitely some people that aren't trained in doing that try to simulate a proper scenario, but do it to the detriment of their students. Can somebody give an example of that and then maybe how we can correct that?
Yeah. So we call them training scars, right? That's what we're talking about, right? Where Ken Murray he said it a long time ago. He talked about the unintended consequences, well-intentioned training, meaning we've run people through scenarios and things like that. And we realize that by complete unintentionally, we maybe have put some bad techniques or things into the file. If you want, I always look at system one thinking as like a big file folder in your head. And basically, when from a recognition prime decision making standpoint, we see a particular set of behaviors, we're primed to go and use a certain response. And when we have bad stuff in the files, unfortunately, it'll default to that as well. So I actually use a video in class, and it's no disparagement to the Michigan State Police that might be on here. I love those guys. I do a lot of work with them. But there's a video of a Michigan State trooper behind a guy in armed robbery suspect in I-94 outside of the city of Detroit. And if you watch the video, he pulls up, the vehicle stops in the middle of the interstate, in the middle of I-94. Trooper gets up pretty close to him, and he exits his vehicle. And I always pause it right there, and I point out, I zoom in on the screen, and there the trooper is a bald-headed white male. So I said, that becomes important in a second. So he gets out of the car, he goes to the back of the car, uses the vehicle's cover. That's all good stuff, except the car is still rolling forward. He didn't put it in park. Obviously, you're just going to have to deal with that. But here's the interesting part. After about 4 or 5 seconds, you see him run back to the door, the driver's side door of the car. And you would think, okay, he's probably putting it in park. What actually happens is he actually reaches in, he gets his hat out, and he puts his trooper hat on. Now, if I told you that story, most people won't believe it. But I have video that actually shows that's happening. So what happens is that's just an example of stuff. It was a totally unintended consequence that actually ends up in your system one thinking. And that's the part we were talking right before I got cut off earlier. I was talking, M asked the question, well, how do we change that? Because it's clearly not effective. That's not what we want people doing in the middle of a felony car stop of an armed robbery suspect outside of Detroit. So that's just one example that I use in our classes. What happens now, we've identified a behavior that we consider less desirable. And every one of us here has been in a position where a boss comes up and says, hey, do we teach that? And you look at a video or a report like, no, actually we don't. Two things have to happen. Number one, the instructor has to be humble enough to say, maybe we do, but we didn't mean to, because we had maybe a poorly prepared scenario, and that happens. The question is now, with the guy M asked earlier, what do we do about it? So if anybody's familiar, I learned this from a professor at Florida State. I can't remember his name. He was an expert on behavioral change, and it's something called the ABCs of behavioral change. I don't know if anybody's heard this or is familiar with it. Absolutely brilliant in its simplicity. So ABCs, there's three parts. It's called the antecedent, behavior, and the consequence. So what happens is, let's say we identified less desirable behavior in a video or training video, or even in a scenario-based training, or the FTO picks up on something. Well, the way to change that is, first of all, we got to know what the desired behavior looks like. So whatever they were doing, we didn't like it. So now we got to identify the behavior. The antecedent simply means this. Antecedent is how we created the actual environment where the desirable behavior can actually occur. Meaning, if I say, well, I want the officer to do this, but I haven't given them the resources or the environment or anything like that, the behavior can't change. And then on the opposite side is consequences. Ideally, consequences should be positive reinforcement, but they can't always be. So what happens is, as you take a look at how to change, smoking is a great example. And you can apply this to scenario-based training, but okay, people are smoking. The desirable behavior is to stop smoking. Now, the A and the B and C have to be closely related. So what I mean by that is everybody knows you're not supposed to smoke. Everybody knows that. But the consequence, and you know, well, the reason you don't smoke is because someday you could get lung cancer and die. That consequence is so far removed from the behavior, it's not likely to change it. You need to have something that happens immediately or very close to the behavior change that either rewards or, in some cases, is a negative consequence. They have to be very closely related. Also, with the antecedent, it's the same thing I said earlier. You have to have the environment, and that also has to be close to the ABC as well. So that might be that somebody uses a nicotine patch, okay, and then they immediately get a result out of it, or they start work. So the behavior changes and they have a positive consequence. We can do the exact same thing in law enforcement training. It's called the ABCs of behavioral change. And the truth is you can change almost any type of behavior with it.
I love it. I think everybody had their pens out. You could hear pens clicking and everyone's taking notes.
I Googled, how do you spell antecedent?
Yeah, I don't know. I had to look it up. So.
Like I was saying before, like there's going to be things that I'll know for next time. One of the things I'm going to do is if I ever have Chris or John back on, I'm going to have like a dictionary that comes up with that explains the terms that they're using. Because
thank you,
a little bit above my head.
And I wish I could remember his name. I can actually provide that name to you of the professor who was doing this behavioral change stuff. Because as I was watching it, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, well that's how you fix performance problems. It was like an epiphany for me. I'm like, we could do the exact same thing, even if it was something like getting people to wear their body armor. Well, first of all, they have to have the body armor, right? And then there has to be a positive consequence for doing it. It can't be, well, if you're in a fight someday or in a gunfight someday, it'll save your life. It has to be something probably it's more closely related. Hey, if everybody on our shift wears their body armor for 30 days, somebody gets a $50 Target gift card, right? And people are like, dude, that won't work. I'm like, really? You think people do like 27? You got roll call and you're at day 27 and somebody shows up without their body armor on. You rest assured somebody's going to say something because like, think it's funny or not. But bottom line, that $50 gift card will get some cops to do some stuff. So,
hey, Adam, I was thinking if the question, I guess, that the person asked the question is asking is why do we do lowest common denominator training generally in the context of like a law enforcement agency providing training? It's because what's the point of the training, right? The learning objective isn't right. Great training. Learning objective likely was that course was not designed so that the cop can win a fight, so that the cop will be protected in this context. It's likely that that type of training, the learning objective was, well, we have to provide 8 hours of training in these categories, says the state, you know, says the regulating body in California, it's POST and other agencies or states, it's whatever. And they worked backwards from that, yeah. Right? They got a list that said, okay, we have to provide training in these things. Now, how are we going to do that? So right there, you started from a very low standard, right? Mm-hmm. The standard is, it's like when you go to renew your driver's license. What are you trying to accomplish there? I have to comply with the law and I got to take this test. It has nothing to do with, are you going to be a good driver? It has even less to do with, are you a professional skilled driver? You go to some private, you know, driving company to get that. If the question is about, you know, fixing training deficiencies, which is what John was mentioning right there, that I think is maybe a separate conversation. How we train that, you know, when we teach field training officer courses is, you know, how do you fix a struggling recruit? Obviously you try to, you know, what is the problem? Well, he can't hear his radio. Okay. Why can't he hear his radio is the next obvious question. Mm-hmm. Can he hear his radio in this context, but not that context? And the simple way that we teach field training officers to try to diagnose is to do that, become a clinician and look for the root cause, the component piece of what's wrong there. Generally, it's going to be a KSA issue of some kind, knowledge, skills, and we call it attitude. Sometimes it's referred to as ability, but can he hear his radio? Does he know what a radio is, first of all? Does he know his call sign? Yes, he does. Okay. Does he understand he's supposed to answer the radio? Son, do you know when to answer the radio? Yeah. I don't think it's a knowledge issue. Is it a skill thing? Does he know how radio works, pushes the button? Can he hear the radio in when there's other things going on? Is it a diverted attention, multitasking issue, or an attitudinal thing? Is he scared of something and he had some auditory exclusion where he couldn't hear it? Is it he's being aloof and doesn't, for whatever reason, want to hear his radio or doesn't want to answer the radio? So I think, you know, fixing training deficiencies is generally like a KSRA issue. The way you fix that is figure out what the root cause is. Mm-hmm. What the unskilled trainer would do in that situation, say the kid can't hear his radio and you're in a field training situation, is just start prescribing methods to fix it. Take your radio home and listen to it. Go sit in the 911 center and listen to radio traffic. You know, just doing more and more of something that's not working isn't necessarily going to fix it. Unfortunately, that's why we see people fail out of courses, or they're not doing well. It's because we're just prescribing a treatment method before we know what's really wrong with them. It'd be like going to the doctor and saying, "Hey, doc, my arm hurts." He's like, "Yeah, we got to amputate that." You know, it's like, well, that's one treatment which may be appropriate for necrotizing fasciitis, gangrene, or something like that. But it wouldn't be appropriate if I just broke my arm because I fell down. We need to do some tests and figure out the root cause first.
Yeah, I'll just add a couple of quick things onto that with respect to lowest common denominator, because I think that question can be taken two different ways, and that is the student themselves the lowest common denominator, or is the training the lowest common denominator? So if the perspective is, you know, well, you've got a group of students, and obviously some of them, you look at the bell curve of human abilities of all the officers that are in your training class, and some of them are going to be lowest common denominator. They're never going to achieve a level of skill and performance as a lot of the other officers. And so to me, this really speaks to the professionalism at the heart of the trainer. And that is, do I care enough about those officers, even though they may be very poor performers, but at the end of my training class, will that officer leave with an enhanced level of performance than when they came in, knowing I'll never get them to the level of a Tony Blauer at the end of my class? That's just unrealistic. But I think sometimes instructors become lazy. They become uncaring about those officers, because as long as their motivation and their desire to train is there, they'll never get to that level. So do you have the skill as a trainer to customize your training to speak to that individual officer's level and incrementally improve them through the training? The other point is the training the lowest common denominator? And an example of this would be, you know, doing your agency's firearm recall, which is an administrative purpose. It's ultimately tactically useless, but we've got to do an agency firearms recall. So if we're going for a day or half a day of firearms training and the firearms recall is part of that, you know what, let's get that recall out of the way in the first 30 minutes. Yep. And so we've got that done. And now I'm going to spend the rest of the training time actually teaching you some combat skills that will help enhance your ability to save your life. So we shouldn't just be default to, well, this is what the minimum standard of what the agency says we have to provide. You know what? That's a necessary but not sufficient end for training. We've got to go continue to push the bar and go consistently above that all the time.
Yeah, I would think too, if police defensive tactics training was the best stuff out there, then, you know, professional MMA fighters would be knocking on our door saying, "Gosh, can you just teach me your guys' techniques? It's just, you know, really the good stuff." And that's not the case. If general law enforcement training, you know, was just the best thing out there, then academia would be knocking on law enforcement's door saying, teach us your ways. You know, you're just, you know, your adult learning theories are just so current. It's just not often the case. So I don't know if it was John or somebody mentioned earlier going outside domains, or maybe Chris, going outside domains, right? Look at what other domains are doing. Aviation, medicine, academia. Don't just because you're a cop or you're a fireman or you're security or whoever's, you know, watching this, don't just be like, well, everything that I need to be a professional at this job and be really, really good at it is contained in the manual they handed me, will be provided by my employer. No, you know, show a little bit of range, you know, show a little bit about wanting to learn from outside domains. And I think you'll be better for it.
I have a question, and it kind of pertains to that when we talk about going outside and getting different types of knowledge and information. Do you like, I mean, it's interesting because the people that are watching this and listening to this are the instructors, are the trainers, they're the guys that are switched on that want to learn, right? This is outside of what they're being paid to do. They're sitting at home right now. They're watching it. They're taking their own time to learn something. We're not talking about those people. We're talking about the instructors that are put in place that only do the bare minimum. Is there a responsibility on the agency to start setting instructor standards once the instructors are part of that cadre?
I personally could see the validity of that. For me, it goes back to the question I asked earlier that Alexis Artwell taught me. Why don't I know what I think I know? And if the answer is, you know, like I said, well, that's the way we've always done it. And I see this most common in agencies. I had an old training lieutenant that used to call it, it's not a great term, but it's what he called it. He called it training incest, which is where the instructors taught the instructors who taught the instructors. And we realized you'd never stepped outside. So my lieutenant was very good about sending us to outside training. And there was an expectation that we would invest in ourselves. I'm big on books, but I never read books. I listen to books on Audible all the time. It's finding what works for you. If you're a person that likes to, one of my guys, he's a hyper nerd. He's an awesome instructor. He's a hyper nerd. That guy reads like two books or a book a week or something like that. Then he types all the notes from the book and he puts them on our Dropbox so the rest of us can get an idea of what the book was about. I mean, so I think there's some of that about, we should not only be the instructors, we should be investing in each other as well. I think there's a lot to do with that. So to me, having minimum training requirements and not, I really thought it was ridiculous. I don't know what the state is like now, but if you were a firearms instructor, when you went to firearms research, it was a 2-hour research. You didn't even shoot. If you went through your driver instructor research, you didn't drive. I mean, you were there for like 2 hours. They talked about updates and that's it. If that's the only thing your agency is doing is bare minimum stuff, I think the agency has an obligation to invest a little bit more in their instructors and set some standards, some level of standard.
Thanks, John. Appreciate that. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, no, I was just going to agree with what John said. And so aside from the technical skill that officers need to be trainers, and we already talked about the characterological ones earlier, I would agree with both Scott and John that a non-negotiable is an insatiable curiosity to learn, a dedication to lifelong learning, a high degree of self-doubt. And when I say self-doubt, I don't mean a lack of confidence, but I mean a healthy dose of doubting what you know and why you know it, and questioning the validity of what you know, going outside, as Scott said, into other domains and disciplines. And learning, there's so much education that's actually available for almost no cost or very minimal cost from all sorts of online organizations around the world around how we learn, human performance, human factors. Read the research. Are you reading the research that's freely available? Mm-hmm. There's hundreds and hundreds of peer-reviewed research articles that you can access for free, that the content would directly improve your ability and performance as a trainer in a variety of different ways. You know, are you doing these things? Are you that dedicated to your craft and to your service to your fellow officers?
Awesome. Before we kind of move on to we have a thousand. There's so many points and so many questions here that people wanted to cover. Does anybody just have anything to touch on? Anything we've talked about so far? John, did you have that video? You spoke. You referenced that video that you use in teaching. Do you actually have that available?
Yeah, I can pull it up. Yeah, it's a technique that we've been using in our decision making classes, and we've got great feedback from it. So. Folks oftentimes say, well, reasonable, that's just, they say, well, you can't actually teach reasonableness. I it's ill-defined, I've heard people say, and my pushback on that is reasonableness is a legal term of art that requires very specific articulation. Well, if you think about reasonable suspicion, for example, it's a legal term of art requiring very specific articulation. Probable cause is a legal term of art that requires specific and articulable articulation. So I find it funny when people say, well, you can't just teach reasonableness. And the truth is that you can. You have to focus. Number one, we talk about reasonableness. We talk about behaviors and options. And here in the United States, we actually focus on behaviors and options and then answering the four, we call them the Graham factors. What was the severity of the crime? There's more to it than this, but answering the basic questions, severity of the crime, immediate threat, active resistance, and evading arrest by flight. So as a way of actually understanding how the courts look at reasonableness, we started doing things we call them our decision-making exercises. We have a series of videos where the officers will watch a portion of a video, and then I stop it at a very specific spot. And so what we ask them to do at that point is articulate the Graham factors, articulate the legal authority, and then describe all the observable behaviors. And then I say, pick a force option. What do you think would be objectively reasonable? And the reason we do this is because this is the way the court looks at reasonableness. If a similarly situated, reasonably well-trained law enforcement officer could have done the same thing, then generally that's going to be reasonable. If no reasonably well-trained, similarly situated officer could do that, it's probably going to be unreasonable. So we just kind of made an exercise out of it. So the one we were talking about the other day, I'll go ahead and bring that up for you.
Yeah, if you can bring it up and throw on the screen share there, I'll share it with everybody. And just while you're doing that, the one thing that it's a commonality that I've found in Canada, in the US and around the world is that understanding of reasonableness. It's somewhere in the law in every country when it comes to criminal codes. And one, and I shared this with all of you before jumping on the call. So you all agreed. So I don't feel stupid sharing it. But this was shared with to me from one of my mentors and instructors out of Ontario, Mike Burgess. And what he said to me was, when you're explaining reasonableness to an officer, or whether it be a security guard, a correctional officer, a sheriff, a deputy, a constable, doesn't matter. When you're explaining reasonableness, you take if you take a cross section of the community that you live in. And it's 50 people, just everybody from all walks of life, all races, all ethnicities, all religions, you know, heights, weights, you know, everything, men, women, everything's different. So you have this huge cross section of your community, and you sit down and you explain, or they watch the scenario as it unfolds, and you explain what happened and why. And if as a group collectively say, they go, yes, that makes sense, then there's a good chance of what you did was reasonable. If they come back and they say something doesn't make sense here, something's not right, then you something was missed somewhere along the line. So, because reasonableness is one of those things that it's so hard to define. It's not like math, right? You can't just say, well, 1 + 1 = 2, because there's so many components to it. There's thousands and thousands of variables.
Yep. Is this showing I'm not able to see. Is it showing the video on the screen?
How's that? Do you want that full screen? Well, we can put it up full. You can talk right over it. Here we go.
Yep.
There you go.
All right. So real quick, this just, and we do both positive and negative. So in theory, here's what we have. We've got reasonably well-trained, and everybody listening, we'll just call them the reasonably well-trained officer. And so what we're going to do, we're going to watch this video unfold, and then we would, I'll just show you how that we do it. So this, the setup on this is, there's a minor shoplifting complaint at a Walmart. The officer, the, not even the primary officer, you'll see the secondary officer that you'll see in this video, tried to stop him. The guy jumps in a van, drives away. And, so he leave, he's about a half mile down the road when another officer stops the vehicle. So that's literally all the real fact pattern that we have at that moment. Minor shoplifting complaint. He did pull away, physically pull away from the officer, jumped in his car. He was able to drive away. So let's watch what happens.
Silver in color, Andre Wilson. How you doing, Central? Tell me how we... Central Race 1, Alpha 6, you don't stop.
Okay, so I'm going to stop right there. Now, we can obviously have a conversation about the tactics of the approach and having your weapon in your hand, that type of thing. But so this is why I stop it, and I'll ask people, all right, what are, you know, what's the severity of the crime? Okay, it's a minor traffic infraction, but some people will say, yeah, but he did flee. And said, okay, cool. Those are all things we should consider. Is he an immediate threat to the officer or others? And people will say, well, he's looking around, but it looks like he's already got one handcuff on. He's trying to get the second handcuff on. I said, yep, great observation. And people say, well, you can't quite tell. He might be actively resisting just a little bit. Can't really tell. So, and my point is, all I want them to do is look at the observable behaviors. That's my whole point. I'm forcing them to focus and articulate on behaviors. So we get to this point here, and I'll say, okay, now that you've done that, and they actually write them down in our workbook. They actually have to write all their thoughts down in the workbook. I'll say, all right, great. Now, what are some force options we could utilize based on the law at this point in time? It's kind of funny. People kind of look and they're like, finish handcuffing them. I'm like, yeah, okay, great. That'd be a great option. Escort them to the back seat. Yep, cool, cool. So I, once I got everybody who said everything they want to say, then I let the video play out. I said, and you'll see what I'm talking about. This is the officer he pulled away from. If you didn't see it, he just dropped his taser on the ground. The guy's fully handcuffed, not fighting. And he drive stuns him in the neck. So I'll just leave that at that. So what I say is, notice that not one person said drive stun him in the neck. Right. So that's probably going to be considered unreasonable. Right. If you look at it, no reasonably well-trained, similarly situated officer could possibly come to the conclusion that dry stunning him in the neck was appropriate. He was fired. And in fact, I don't think he was criminally charged or it's pending. But so we use examples like that. That one's pretty extreme. But I also do the other side. I'll say, let's watch the video. And people say, oh, wait, that he's an immediate threat. And they'll start articulating those gram factors. I'll pause the video. I say, I make them write it all out again. I said, what are some options? And somebody might say, we could probably tase him. Oh, hey, in this situation, we're going to use extended range, non-lethal weapons or whatever that might be. Then I play the video out. And that's exactly what happens. Whatever they said is what happens. I said, listen, that's exactly how. So guess what? You guys are a collective of similarly, reasonably well-trained, similarly situated officers. And you all said basically the same thing, these one or two options. That's the point for us, is that that's how you get to understanding reasonableness a little bit more. And the key to it is we should be exposed. Once we've taught them reasonableness in the academy, they and I would use this for roll call training and stuff like that, or just pushing them out to MDTs. We can do these short little decision-making exercises. They don't take long. We practice more of the articulation I was talking about earlier, and it does help us understand. It gives us a broader context. Okay, what is reasonable and what's not? So it's just something we started doing for what it's worth.
All right, that concludes part two of our three-part episode pulled from our instructor's roundtable. You can view the whole video at thebreakdown.ca/IRT. And make sure to join us on the last Thursday of every month. We're going to be rolling out these instructor's roundtables at 1800 Central, the next one on officer-involved shootings, and is going to be in partnership with Caliber Press. If you're in law enforcement, you're more than familiar with Caliber Press and the content that they produce. We are so excited and honored to be partnering with them for this moving forward. As always, if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, please consider doing so if you find this information actionable and useful to you. We appreciate the love and support as always, and I look forward to seeing you next time on The Breakdown. Stay safe.